Hello and welcome to the programme. You can visit our website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Okay, so a very busy programme ahead of us tonight here on Mooney Goes Wild. Last Monday, you may have seen some news that common crane chicks were born in Ireland for the first time in 300 years. This was a story we featured with Mark McCorry, who works with Bord na Móna, some months ago when they were actually building the nest and incubating. We were wondering, would they actually breed? And now it seems they have. Niall Hatch is at his home in Greystones. He can give us an update on that. Aina Nealana is with me in studio. She's back from County Clare. Aina, how are you getting on?
I'm hale and hearty, Derek, and here in the flesh. Don't I look great?
Oh, fantastic. I haven't seen you for 300 years, it feels. Anyway, Niall, tell us about these cranes.
Yeah, very exciting news, Derek. So these common cranes, we shouldn't be misled by the name. They're anything but common in an Irish context. Mm-hmm. They haven't been successfully recorded breeding in Ireland for over 300 years. It's a really a species that was quite well known here in the medieval period, but which became very rare due to destruction of boglands and overhunting and finally disappeared. So it was with great excitement that we heard the news this year that on a bogland, a re-wetted bogland area in the Midlands at a secret undisclosed location, a pair of cranes were showing nesting behaviour. They're doing their courtship dancing, they're doing their bugling sounds that they do that would suggest that they were getting ready to pair up and to produce young. Two eggs were laid and they successfully hatched out, which is that's really the landmark, because there have been breeding attempts over the last 2 years, but they were unsuccessful. The eggs never hatched, but this time they did, and two young chicks were produced. Now, sadly, after a while, those chicks disappeared. They vanished off the radar, and it seems likely that a predator such as a fox must have grabbed them. They certainly seem to have disappeared. So that's a very sad outcome. Having said that, cranes are long-lived birds. Those parents, they have to learn the tricks of the trade. They really need to learn to practice their breeding. And so as time goes on, they'll hopefully become more successful. And who knows, this may be the start of the recolonization of this species here in Ireland. And how wonderful that would be, because it's a magnificent creature that we thought was lost forever from Ireland. One of the biggest birds anyone would ever see. They stand almost 5 foot tall if they stretch their necks up. They're absolutely enormous. A bird that, for our ancestors would have been very well known, but for in recent times, really not known to people here in Ireland at all. So very exciting news.
Yeah, Neil, you were saying that these cranes have laid eggs in other years. So are they the actual same cranes? Do we know they're the same pair, or were they just a pair of cranes saw a nice place to breed and came and had a go and went off again? Or is it the same pair returning each time, getting better at it, do you reckon?
I would reckon it's probably the same pair, because cranes pair for life and they're very faithful. They stay together for a lot of the year. They're a migratory species, so they would only be in Ireland and indeed in much of Europe for only the summertime, really. But what happens is that there's no way to know for sure, but it's probably the same pair, I would say. There wouldn't be that many pairs of cranes knocking around the Midlands. But it's interesting that they found this habitat. They knew this is exactly the kind of habitat that's ideal for nesting in. Good open space, lots of wetland around the area. An area where they can see predators approaching as well. So it seems like they've chosen well, and hopefully they'll be successful in future years. This pair, the adults, will live to breed another day.
It's a real mark of confidence, isn't it, in the re-wetting of the cutaway bog, meaning a vote of confidence in this environmental management that gives us a habitat that brings us back to being much more biodiverse than was there before.
Yes, I think that the destruction of our peat bogs across Ireland is a tragedy. I think it's something that future generations will really regret and will rue. But it's good to see at least that many of those depleted bogs now, they are being returned to a natural habitat. It will take a very long time, thousands and thousands of years, before they are proper true peat bogland again, with all of the benefits that has for our ecosystem and for our wildlife. But it's the next best thing. These wonderful wetlands where it can support things like cranes and many different breeding ducks and waders and so on. So from that point of view, it's very much to be welcomed. We hopefully you'll see more of this happening now as Bord na Móna step up this restoration and re-wetting work. So it's really good to see, and it shows the benefits can happen really quickly. It's not long ago this was re-wetted and all of a sudden cranes move in. It's really interesting.
Good news. I can't wait to see them in the flesh here in Ireland. Anyway, let's stay with birds, because new findings from zoologists at Trinity College Dublin working with birds in Southeast Asia is shining fresh light on evolution. Their research shows that species can diversify surprisingly quickly under certain conditions. Now, they looked at islands which, like Ireland, were once connected to larger territories by land bridges. The bird they studied is called the Sulawesi Babbler. a very shy bird that lives on Indonesian islands. You can hear it there in the background, can't you? Very shy, but it calls all the same. And that call was very important to their studies. Fionn O'Markey is first author on the paper and a PhD candidate in Trinity College's School of Natural Sciences. He says everyone has heard of Darwin's finches evolving completely different bill shapes on the Galapagos Islands. The Galapagos are isolated out in the Pacific, so the birds there have had millions of years to evolve separately. But, he says, sometimes evolution can occur on much smaller scales of time and space. Fionn joins us now from his home in Blackrock. Hello, Fionn, how are you today?
Hello, I'm very well, thanks. Thank you for having me on.
Well, we're delighted to have you on. So tell us about your work.
For my PhD in Trinity in the Zoology Department, I've been part of this ongoing project that works with scientists in Indonesia to look at the evolution of birds on different islands and how the populations are changing and how that might be leading to new species evolving. Most recent paper, we were looking at one particular species, the Sulawesi babbler, and we were interested to see how much it had been evolving on the islands where we studied it.
You're a modern-day Charles Darwin, it seems, so tell us all about the Sulawesi babbler.
Yeah, so it's one species from this big family of babblers, which are these kind of nondescript-looking birds. There's a lot of them living on different islands in Southeast Asia, and this particular species, it only lives on Sulawesi and the islands off Sulawesi's coast. So Sulawesi is a big island in the middle of Indonesia. If you look at a map, it actually stands out quite a bit because it's got this very funny shape. It's shaped like the capital letter K or something like that. And it's a really interesting place to look at evolution.
And can you describe the bird for me, please?
If you saw it in your back garden at home, you might hardly notice it, which is a funny thing to say about a tropical bird. It's not very colourful. It's kind of dull brown coloured. It's maybe the size of a starling would be a good comparison. And it doesn't look particularly remarkable, which is part of why it would pass by people's notice a lot of the time. And it's interesting to look at species like that because maybe less attention has been paid to them in some cases.
So what you've actually been discovering, Fionn, is that the rate of evolution on this particular bird, because that's the one you're studying, has been happening at a faster rate than we would have thought, or at least that some people would have thought. I mean, the general thought about evolution is that that species change over a very long period of time. I mean, the one that we all think about originally is the Galapagos Islands and the finches, and the Galapagos Islands rose up out of the sea. They were never joined to South America, and the finches that got blown out there somehow never met any other finches again, and slowly over the millions of years evolved until Darwin came out and his cook pointed out to him that they were all different on different islands. But what you're looking at here now is the fact that these birds are changing at a much quicker rate because you were able to work out when they were separated from their colleagues, if you like, because where you're finding them are on islands that were connected by land bridges, and the land bridges only vanished at the end of the last ice age. So we're talking about thousands of years, not millions of years. And that it seems from what you've been discovering in your research that this is a very fast speed for a new species to evolve. Have I got my head around it as you are describing it?
Yes, that's it exactly. And that's why it's quite an interesting story. So evolution generally is quite a slow process, and the most dramatic changes take millions of years, and the big groups diversifying in different ways and things like that. And in fact, even in the same region where this study has taken place, my supervisors, Nicola Marples and Dave Kelly at the Zoology Department in Trinity, have published a fair amount of research on different birds on these same islands. It's an interesting place to compare different kinds of islands, because there are also other islands that are more similar to the Galapagos further out from Sulawesi. So these are ones that came up from coral under the sea and from plates moving around. And like the Galapagos, they're isolated out in the sea and have never been connected to the bigger land masses. Yeah, whereas the Sulawesi babbler wouldn't even make it out to those islands. It only lives on the close islands near the shore. And other species then will have evolved into new species or into new populations on those remote islands, but not in this study. So the Sulawesi babbler is standing out from some of the other species in the same region in this way.
because, I mean, where you're actually speaking of Sulawesi and Borneo, and there's a huge depth in the sea between one and the other. And this was actually what they called the Wallace's line when Albert Wallace was doing his studies around Darwin's time in the 1800s. You had all the different wildlife and how remarkably they were in the Australian continent, and then you had the Southeast Asian ones, and there was an actual cut off, a divide where one lot ended and the other began. There was no sort of general continuity, and this was what he called the Wallace's line, where one lot stopped and the other began. So that's what you're referring to there besides Sulawesi, because Sulawesi is actually on the Australian side of that line, it's not on the Asian side, so that there was no connection, even though the islands appear to be close, because of the huge amount of depth of ocean, and they wouldn't fly across, as you say. So that's one thing. But another thing that strikes me about evolution, in fact, lots of things strike me, I'm very interested in evolution. One of the things is that we wouldn't have known this if we didn't have DNA analysis, because if you analyse species, what is a species? A species is something that can't interbreed with another species successfully and have fertile offspring. And the reason why it can't do that is because there is a difference, there is a significant difference in its DNA, and the significant difference is about 1% difference. So by being able to look at species and look at their DNA, we can measure the difference and then determine that they are in fact a different species. I mean, if you think of Ireland, and we had the wood white butterflies, we just had what I was doing, wood white butterflies way back in Forest Forbach in the biological records day in the 70s, there was just their wood white butterfly. But with research that they've done on DNA analysis, now we have two wood white butterflies, two different ones. They look exactly the same, but their DNA is different, and then they're able, looking at them then, to maybe say, well, one's in a slightly different habitat to the other. The same with the pipistrelle bats. They were just the pipistrelle bat. Now we have the pipistrelle and common pipistrelle, the soprano pipistrelle, and they have been separated by DNA analysis. So as I gather from what you're saying about the babbler, the reason you know it's a different species is by DNA analysis. So, I mean, how do you know how long it took then? How do you know it evolved so quickly if you didn't even know? I don't mean you personally, but if it wasn't known that it was a different species until it was found out by DNA analysis.
Yes, part of what's so fascinating about studying evolution in this part of the world in particular is that as well as the biodiversity itself being remarkable and our picture of that biodiversity changing all the time as new information comes out, you're also contributing to a really long line of research that's been very important in evolutionary biology. As you say, since the beginning of evolutionary biology, when Alfred Russel Wallace co-discovered it in Southeast Asia. The really remarkable thing about Wallace's line, he pointed out two small islands on either side of it, Bali and Lombok. They're about as physically distant from each other as Ireland is from Great Britain, but they're about as different in the animals that live on them as Great Britain and Japan, because there's almost a sharp dividing line between them, which came to be known as Wallace's line. So the islands we're looking at, they're all on the same side of Wallace's line, the ones in this study. So they're disconnected from everything on the other side, such as Borneo. Borneo is on the other side of the line. But then these islands are all quite closely connected to each other. So within just tens of thousands of years, they're all connected by land, the same way that Ireland was to the European continent when the sea levels dropped during the Ice Ages. And today we're able to look at the same kinds of populations that people like Alfred Russel Wallace did, but with new techniques, like you say, using DNA. But one of the interesting things is that it's still not all about DNA, because sometimes you can get a misleading picture if you're just looking at DNA. So what we make an effort to do is to incorporate DNA and morphology, so kind of body size and the shapes and sizes of different body parts, and the song of the birds as well. And if you see the same patterns reflected in these different kinds of data, that's a good indication that it's a real pattern that you're seeing. So with this study, we haven't named new species of the birds, but we've made an argument that they should be seen as different subspecies. So if they came into contact again, they probably would be able to reproduce, but they're sort of maybe on the way to evolving into new species. And they have definitely evolved differences between the populations that are recognizable and that are reflected in those different kinds of data, the same pattern.
So
that's kind of remarkable, because at the moment they're all called one subspecies. So they're not, even within the same species, they're thought to be all just exactly the same almost. And we're showing that they're not, even though they look quite similar.
To recap now, just to say, what you're saying is you're looking at these birds on different islands that were connected tens of thousands of years ago, not millions, tens of thousands. So tens of thousands of years ago, this was the same species of bird. And in the last tens of thousands of years, which is a very small period of time in evolutionary terms, these birds are evolving into different species. That's what the premise is. So the question is now, why is this happening? Because generally what drives evolution is environmental change. And we know this. We know this from smaller things like bacteria. When you change the environment for the bacteria then will mutate and become a different one because its environment has changed. So is the environment in these islands changing? I mean, has this bird got something to do with the amount of nickel in the soil? Is this a cause? I mean, why is the environment changing there rapidly enough so that the bird has to adapt in order to be able to survive in a changing environment? Because it's not just the bird, it's the bird and the environment that gives us evolution. So what's with the environment then that's changing there?
Yes, you've brought up a couple of important things to consider. The isolation of a species or of a population is an aspect of itself as well as the environment around it. So even though other birds that we've looked at in this region are all the same across these islands, the Sulawesi babbler is showing this other pattern where it's evolving differently on the different islands. And we think that its behaviour is part of this because it's what we call an understory species. It hangs out in the undergrowth. It's even been compared to a mouse or to an animal like that in terms of how it feeds and how it behaves, because it kind of hops around on or near the ground. It doesn't like to fly longer distances. So even though this bird physically could cross between these islands quite easily, we think it's not inclined to do that just because it likes to hang out near the ground. And that allows islands that are quite close to each other to have distinct populations that don't mix with each other. But you're right, the environments on those islands also need to be somewhat different for these differences to have evolved, because they need to be adapting to something on those islands. And in this case, we have seen that the islands that have the most distinct populations of this bird also have the most distinct geology from the other islands. So there's what's called ultramafic geology and ultramafic soil. It's very heavy in certain minerals that are in the rocks from the volcanism, from the magma, and then they get into the rocks and from there into the soils. So they're actually quite poor soils. They're quite toxic to a lot of plants, which means that only certain plants can grow on them, which means that the animals on those islands then need to adapt to what plants can grow there. There might be different foods available and so on. And that's why particular islands are going to be different from other ones, even though they haven't been separated for a very long time.
Yeah, because when you're talking about them being little skulking underground birds, I'm thinking of the kiwis in the South Island in New Zealand. They have different species of kiwis on different parts. And again, they don't fly at all, actually. But they don't seem to be, maybe they're not doing the studies on them. They're saying they're staying to be the same species because the environmental conditions on those islands is the same. It's the problem with the kiwis is that they've been predated by rats and things brought in. So that's a different harassment on them. So the environment then certainly has to do with it, because that's the problem, isn't it, with climate change and global warming. Our environment is changing at a faster rate than species can evolve in order to keep up with it. I mean, the polar bear is the typical example that lives on ice. If there's no ice, how will the polar bear manage? He can't suddenly develop flippers or something and become a sea animal. He can't, and catch seals is what he lives on. So it's the race between being able to change quickly enough to adapt to a changing environment. So your research does indeed seem to be very timely.
Yes, and one of the kind of sad ironies about it is that the places that are maybe going to be the most affected by things like climate change in the tropics, places that are already very warm, are the most biodiverse, and also where the human population is maybe the most vulnerable as well. Talking about very poor countries in a lot of cases. With the Sulawesi babbler, with the islands that we've looked at, the ultramafic islands with all of that nickel in the rock and in the soil, it's kind of a sad irony that that same nickel is now being sought by these massive mining companies. So the same islands that are the most likely to have distinct populations are the ones that are under the most threat. And it's places that haven't been suitable for conversion into plantations in the past. So the kind of mountainous interior of islands like Wawoni, which is one of the islands we've studied, is where the mines are going to go now. And that's causing conflict with the local farmers because the big mining companies are making impositions on their land and so on, and there's a lot of money behind it. So it's very true that these places that are very biodiverse and very important to people who live there are under a lot of threat from that kind of development. And we don't even know in many cases what the biodiversity is. Some of these islands hadn't really had much organized ornithological work done on them for centuries in some cases. So our team that combined scientists from Ireland and from Indonesia published some of the first research in centuries on some of the birds on some of these islands. So we don't even know what we're going to be losing in some cases.
Niall, have you ever seen a Sulawesi babbler?
I haven't, Derek. I've not been to Sulawesi, although it's high on my list of places to go because it's got so many unique birds. But I've seen many other species of babbler around parts of Asia. And they're very interesting and very diverse family of birds. Some of them are quite showy and some are brightly coloured. But ones like the Sulawesi babbler, as Fiona's saying, they're very skulking, they're very drably plumaged, and they tend to slip below the radar. And what I find really interesting about this research as well is how it's looking not just at the DNA, as Fiona said, but also at the vocalisations, the songs of these birds. Because very often when it comes to these very drab forest species, physical appearance isn't particularly important to them. They're not choosing their mates or choosing who would get the best territory or so on the basis of how bright the plumage of the bird is. It all comes down to the song. And I think that sometimes DNA, although it's a really important aspect of research, it's unveiling a lot about evolution, I think it can be overstated as well, because so much of evolution really comes down to random chance, that a mutation in a gene arises that confers a benefit on the owner of that gene or on the organism that then gives it a higher survival chance and it passes on its genes to the next generation. And it's possible in some cases for a spontaneous mutation to arise that could very quickly lead to reproductive isolation, but yet the bird may look, or other creature indeed, may look absolutely identical. But of course, so much of the mate selection of these birds does come down to their songs. So I'm curious, Fionn, when it comes to the actual vocalizations of these birds recording their songs and their calls, what sort of differences are you noticing? For example, would you be able to tell which island one of these babblers came from just from hearing its song?
Absolutely true point that the song is a really important thing to consider in bird evolution. In a lot of ways, we're actually quite lucky with birds. They're a nice group to study, partly because they're so vocal. It gives you another kind of data you can look at. And because it's a pre-mating signal, it's a really good indication of whether two populations are mixing with each other. If one is singing differently than the other population, then the birds won't be recognizing each other. And then when we talk about islands having potentially different food sources available because of the geology, if their beaks evolve slightly differently to adapt to a different food source, that can impact their song even physically if the bill changes size or shape. So they call it a magic trait because it kind of reinforces itself almost. The change in the bird's body can change its signaling, which then changes how it mates and how it evolves. One of the things that kind of turned us onto the Sulawesi babbler was noticing in the field that they sounded quite different in different places, because they are a very vocal bird. They're skulking and shy in that they rarely come out of the undergrowth, but they do sing very prominently in the kind of the dawn chorus of Sulawesi. So as the team was going around different islands, we kind of thought, these ones do sound a little bit different, but how can we be systematic about that? There's a kind of an established methodology you use here, where you take recordings from different populations and you feed them into this program where then you can measure the peak frequency of the song, other traits like that. So that's the frequency at which the signal is strongest, and then how long the song goes on for, how much the frequency changes over the course of it and things like that. And then that can give you a more objective answer of how different they are. Combination of observations in the field and then quantitative study on the computer and in the lab that kind of come together for this sort of work.
Of course, Fionn, in Ireland, we, of course, are an island that was once connected by a land bridge, as we've already mentioned. And we have started to see that incipient speciation process happening with some birds and indeed some other taxa here in Ireland as well. So we have our four endemic subspecies that are often mentioned here. We have, for example, the jay, the coltit, the red grouse and the dipper, where we have distinct, subtly distinct, but still diagnosably different Irish populations. I'm wondering, and I don't know, maybe you could shed some light on this for us, whether any work has been done at a genetic level and also at an acoustic level to see perhaps whether we have other cryptically hidden subspecies of these birds in Ireland that, of course, if time progresses and these birds continue for thousands more years, may eventually lead to speciation, becoming full species in their own right.
That's a very good question. I'm not sure what work has been done genetically and acoustically. I know some has, and I know that when these subspecies and endemic taxa like that are named today, it's generally on the back of, it's what we call integrative taxonomy. It's bringing together the DNA and the song and whatever else you have access to. And one of the great things about the birds in Ireland is that whatever work has been done so far, and I know some has been, there is access to data that more can always be done. So there are these repositories where people upload the DNA sequences that their lab has generated and the songs that their group might have recorded. So Xenocanto is the website that has all the bird songs. Actually, people listening to this might be interested. They can go on there and listen to bird songs of different species from all around the world. But you can download from there and have different comparison points. So I have seen some work on some birds using that kind of methodology in Europe as well. And a lot of it has been uploaded from Ireland and from other European countries. So there's plenty to work with on into the future.
It's fascinating to listen to, I have to say. So thank you very much indeed, Fiona, and continued success with your work and the team there at Trinity College. Just before you go, if it is identified as a subspecies, will it get a new name?
Yes, and it's funny because one of the populations we looked at used to have its own name, and then it got abolished because based on the plumage, it was hard to tell them apart, really. But now we've been able to go back in with these other kinds of data and show that it really was its own thing. So it's a third name. A species has a binomial name, and then a subspecies has the third part. So Pelornium celebense is the species, and this population was Pelornium celebense improbatum. It's a funny name because it means like dishonest. And then it had another name, Sordidum, so it was named as being kind of sordid and dirty and bad. But then they had to change that because there was already a different subspecies called Sordidum. So I don't know how offensive these babblers were that all these taxonomists were calling them sordid and dishonest and all the rest of it. But for whatever reason, they've ended up with quite insulting names.
Where does the name babbler come from, Niall, by the way?
I think it's a reference to the sort of chattering call and song of many of these birds. It's a very widespread group of birds throughout much of Asia, particularly in the tropical regions, and some of them are very vocal indeed. They make all sort of chattering noises, so I think that's the origin of it.
But it was only given to them by English speakers. I'm sure the people out there had their own names for the birds. I mean, this is gas. You know, we put an English name on something and then that's the name, we only discovered it a couple of hundred years ago, whereas it was always the name on it before, like the poor whale in America that was called the sleeping bird by the native Indians, and it was only our lot, or the white people, that came along and called it the poor will. So, you know, what's in a name?
Ain't any louder. Right, anyway, thank you very much indeed, Fionn. We'll talk to you again.
No, thank you so much. Yeah, I enjoyed that a lot.
Good luck to Fionn. Now let's say hello to Terry Flanagan, who's with our old friend Jenny Brannigan up in Sandyford, not too far from where we are now. Terence, how are you getting on?
Yes, Derek, I am indeed. I'm out in Sandyford and I'm with an old friend of the programme, Jenny Brannigan. And you'll remember about this time last year we were here because Jenny had sparrows nesting over the door of our business, just as you go in and out of the business. Well, this year she's got birds nesting again, but they're a little bit more advanced. They're fledglings. Now, a lot of people get mixed up with those terms, nestling and hatchling and fledgling. Well, a hatchling is when the little birdie just emerges from the egg. And that's about the first day or 2 days of its life. And then after that, it develops into what's called a nestling. And then when it leaves the nest, it's referred to as a fledgling. So fledglings, we come across them quite often. We see them in the garden hopping around. But it's at this stage of their lives that they're most vulnerable. It's reckoned that only about 30% of fledglings actually make it to their first birthday. So what should you do if you see a fledgling on the lawn? Well, this is something we've covered lots of times on the programme before. And the answer quite simply is leave it alone. Just have a look at it. See, is it injured? Is it damaged? Is there blood on it? If not, just leave it. I know when you look at it, it looks crazy. It looks like this little ball of fur. The feathers are all over the place. It's got a little stumpy tail. It's not great at flying, but it should be able to hop around the place and everything will be okay with it. Now, if you are worried that there might be cats or other predators around, well, then you can take it and lift it up and put it in a bush or on a branch of a tree or so. Well, anyway, getting back to Jenny. Jenny had an interaction with a fledgling here only yesterday. Jenny, tell us your story.
Well, Terry, you know at the moment that everybody has the doors and windows open for ventilation, so it's no different here at work. So we had our main clinic door open, we had our windows open, and suddenly a little bird flew into the clinic reception. So it flew in, it landed up on one of the open doors, and we were watching it to see, well, what's going to happen next? And then we thought, like, this is a bit of a problem because we have all glass at the front of the clinic. So we thought it might get confused, and sure enough, it did. It tried to fly out the side door, and it hit the glass, and it landed down on the ground. So it looked very shook at that stage. You could see that it was kind of trembling. So Deirdre, who works with me here, she picked it up in her hand and it was very afraid. It was clinging on with its little claw to her finger. You could really see it visibly. And we actually sent in a photo of that. You can see it really clearly in the picture. We got some water, so we cut out a little small kind of polystyrene cup, little small amount of water in it. And the bird had some water and it took a couple of minutes, but it completely perked up then. So then we weren't sure what to do with it. We didn't know where it had come from. It obviously looked very small. And we were thinking, you know, what's going on with this? What are we going to do? So what we did was we put it back outside the clinic then. We left the little small cup of water with it. And then we were trying to take pictures of it because, again, this is quite unusual. This wouldn't normally happen to us, you know, on a day-to-day basis. So we thought, right, I know exactly the person who will want to hear about this. So we were taking pictures for you, Derek.
Thank you, Jenny.
And then we left the bird outside and within literally a couple of seconds, it flew off into the bush just beside where the clinic is. Did we do the right thing?
Yes, indeed you did. It's not an uncommon thing to hear of these birds flying into windows. And what you should do is really just, if you can find the bird, see, is it stunned? It probably will be stunned. So take it, have a quick look at it. Generally, they don't break wings or break legs in situations like this, but they often have internal injuries or they may be concussed. So what you should do really is take it and put it into an old cardboard box, like a shoe box. Put it into the dark, keep it somewhere quiet, somewhere fairly warm, not too warm for them. Leave them for there for half an hour or so. Then take it out, put it onto the grass, open the top and see if he flies away. And if he flies away, he'll probably fly into the nearest bush. And just observe him for a little while, maybe 10 minutes or so. See that everything is okay. And then he'll get his bearings and he'll fly away. If he doesn't leave the box, take it back in again for another half hour or so and repeat it. And if he doesn't leave it after an hour or 2 hours, well, then maybe you need to take him to the vet. And when you bring them to the vet, vets are great because they look after wildlife for free. But generally, they're just stunned and they will make it on their own.
But Terry, why do they fly into windows in the first place?
Well, that's a really good question. There's a number of reasons why they might fly in. First of all, they might be looking for a safe place to land. Secondly, they might be at the time being chased by a predator, something like a kestrel or a sparrowhawk or something. And they see this darkness, it's somewhere different, somewhere they haven't been before. Maybe they think they can fly in here and hide and get away from it. Also, they can't see glass. I know we can't see glass either, but when we look at a window, we know it's a window and we know that there's glass in it. We know because we can see the handle, we've seen it opened, we've touched it before. Birds can't see the glass and sometimes they think it's just an opening. And we're standing here beside the window. Have a look in that window now and tell me exactly what you see.
I can see a full reflection. I can see trees. I can see the blue sky. I can totally see what you mean now, where the bird would be.
So the bird sees that and what he sees is, oh, it's an invitation to fly in that direction. So that's why they tend to fly into windows. They don't actually see it. They think they're going somewhere else.
That's amazing. So is there anything we can do to stop that, or is that just something that's going to happen from time to time?
Well, it is going to happen, but there are things you can do. You can buy these stickers that you can put on the windows. You see them in Birdwatch Ireland and various other shops, and they portray something like birds, like hawks. That people used to think when you put them up, they look like a hawk and that it would frighten the birds away. No, that, it doesn't work like that at all. It just sees this sticker on the window, and if you have a number of them on the window, they realise that this is a wall, really. It's not actually an opening. So put the stickers up in the window. That's probably the best thing you can do.
We have a sticker of a human hand and a person like running through a finish line on our window, and yet he still came through.
Well, these ones I was thinking of, that these are the silhouettes. They're the kind of the black ones. They're much easier for the bird to see. I don't know if you've seen those. But
no, I have them.
I've had them in the lab in school for many years. Because for that reason, a number of birds did fly into the window. And I believe it or not, they did work. But you need to put a good few of them on the windows. And again, remember, it's not the hawk effect. It's just that they're seeing something and they're knowing not to fly into it.
Yeah, it's interesting. When you said that there, I was thinking, is it similar to scarecrow, the idea of that? But apparently not.
And of course, the other thing that happens is in this very, very hot weather, you might open windows that you're not used to opening. And they'll open out onto maybe an alleyway in, say, in your back garden or something like that. So this could be a natural flight path for the birds to go up and down. And then all of a sudden you're opening this window, they don't see the window, and bang, they crash into it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's really interesting, isn't it? And actually, we were fascinated by it because we were looking at the bird, trying to figure out what type of bird it was. Mm-hmm. And one thing that confused us then was we were looking at its beautiful, distinctive yellow tail, and there was lovely black in it. But then when we were looking it up on Birdwatch Ireland's website, we couldn't find a particular match. And actually, I spoke to my dad then, who is a massive bird lover, and he was telling me that it was a baby goldfinch then. And the babies don't have the distinctive red face, and this one didn't.
It is a goldfinch now. It's a baby goldfinch, and it's a bit difficult to tell at this early stage. But as you say, when you look down at the wings there, you can see that distinctive yellowing in the wings. Of course, the goldfinch has this lovely red and white and black face. In Irish, it's referred to as Lossar Quilla, the wood flame or the light of the forest. Isn't that a lovely name?
That's a fantastic name.
Now, your little one here, that hasn't got that red face yet, but it will get it. They've got those striking colours. They're a very distinctive bird, and they're coming to the garden more and more often now. 20, 30, 40 years ago, before people really got into feeding birds in the garden, we didn't see them that often. But they are attracted to the nuts, the nut feeders, and they particularly like Niger seed. Niger seed is a very, very small seed, and you need a particular feeder for it. And they've got these really fine beaks that they can actually get in and get this seed. They normally would eat teasel or thistle or that, but they are a beautiful bird and they are becoming more and more common. And that little one that you had there, well, he'll develop his colours over the next couple of months or so.
I noticed that he was really quiet when he was with us in reception, and he made no noise at all. Is that just because he's a fledgling and his song develops, or was that just because he was stunned?
Well, I think it was a bit of both. He certainly was stunned. You know yourself, if you have, say, a bad fall, if you trip over a step or something like that and you fall on the ground, the only thing you might do is groan out of you, but you're not going to be singing a song. And yes, the young birds like that, they don't sing as such. They do call out to the parents and the parents will call to them. But he really was just stunned, and he's just trying to, first of all, say, what's after happening? And, you know, what am I going to do now? And he really just needs to get his bearings in that.
Did we do well then, Terry, in how we looked after this little baby goldfinch?
Yes, you did, because you managed to see him get away, and that's the important thing. And they are a beautiful bird. And talking about the singing, they are beautiful singers. And did you know the collective name for goldfinches?
I certainly do not.
Well, they're referred to as a charm of goldfinches, and it comes from the old English word chirm, describing its twittering song. And when you hear those adults just twittering away, it's really the most beautiful sound that you can hear.
Oh, that sounds lovely. We were looking for its mother to see, could we see where it was flying to, but we didn't see it. We'll have to keep an ear out outside the clinic now for that sound.
Well, the little baby bird managed to get away, so well done.
Thanks, Terry. We were delighted. And actually, it was really nice just to see how it all happened and that it was able to fly away, because actually we wouldn't have really known what to do if he had stayed stunned, and if he wasn't well, we hadn't even realised that you could bring them to the vet. So that's great to know now that he was fine, and in future that we could do that if he didn't recover as well.
So Derek, there you have it from Sandyford. A happy ending to a lovely story.
Indeed it is, Terry. Thank you. And Jenny, Niall Hatch, this can be a problem for people if they've got a lot of glass about their house.
Yes, it can be a huge problem, Derek. Birds, especially this time of year, we have youngsters who are out who are not accustomed to flying. They really don't know the dangers of the world yet, and they don't realise that glass is a threat. Two things can happen. They can sometimes see, if it's like something like a conservatory or a greenhouse, they can see light coming through from both sides, so they think it's just space they can fly through. Or more commonly what happens is they see the reflection of the sky in a pane of glass or perhaps of some trees or something, and they think that they can fly there and land, and then of course they fly full force into the window and they can suffer very severe brain damage as a result. It's very often fatal, so it can be a big problem, and we'd get it reported probably more at this time of year than any other because of so many young birds out taking their first flights.
Richard Collins joins us now from his home in Malahide. Richard, any suggestions on what people can do to prevent this from happening in the first place?
Well, nowadays, Derek, there's often a window in front in the lounge and a partition-y thing and into the back kitchen, say, and then another window. Now, if the bird can see right through, a bird fly, this is the case in my own house, I have to keep the partition closed. Otherwise, the bird out front might think it's a quick route to the back garden by flying at the glass. And of course this is dreadful, and I've had birds hit the glass, I must admit, but not when I keep the partition closed. So a few simple things can help this, I think.
All right, now have a listen to this sound, if you would, please. This is the call or the song of the humpback whale. Humpback whale song is one of the longest and most complex of any animal. A single call can last up to 30 minutes, I'm told. And it is something we should be hearing more of off our shores. A new humpback whale, nicknamed Orion, has been sighted for the first time in Irish waters, approximately 60 kilometres northwest of Malin Head in County Donegal. The whale was sighted on board the Marine Institute's RV Celtic Explorer as part of the annual Western European Shelf Pelagic Acoustic, or WESPAS, WESPAS survey. WESPAS survey scientist Kieran O'Donnell of the Marine Institute says observing any apex predator in its natural environment is exciting, but a new humpback whale for Irish waters, this is very special. Kieran joins us now from his office in Galway. Hello, Kieran. How special was it? Were you there at the time? Did you hear it?
Hello, hi, thanks for having me on the show. Yes, it was an amazing sighting. It always is. You can't see an animal of this size and this of an iconic nature like a humpback whale and not get excited about it.
So can you describe for the listeners what a humpback whale looks like? There are so many whales in our waters. What does a humpback whale look like? Why does it stand out? How majestic is it?
These animals are really a sight to behold up close. They can grow up to sort of 17 metres in length, which is a huge animal if you can compare it to something close by to you now, that's 17 metres. And they have this remarkable sort of feeding and diving profile while they'll often show their tail, which is always a lovely thing to see and something that you'll see on nature programmes when you're watching the telly in the evening. So yeah, they're a really nice animal to see up close. This new animal was one of several in the area, along with some Rizzo's dolphins, common dolphins, bottlenose dolphins, white-sided dolphins and minke whales that were all feeding in the area at the same time.
Richard.
Hello, Kieran. How are you? You have the life, I must say, out on these boats, fed and fasted and used to all day.
Hi, Richard. How are you doing?
They're very interesting animals, I must say. They're in a subfamily of their own among the baleen whales. They are fairly unique. They're quite different from the others, and they're quite cooperative with each other. Baleen whales generally do not cooperate feeding, but these fellows do. They produce these bubble circles, trapping the fish inside, and then they all veil up the fish inside the bubble sort of thing. They're also very rare in Ireland, going back to Mayo at the time of the whaling. I looked up the statistics and I found that 6 were landed in Mayo, only 6 between 1908 and 1914. And then in the period 1920-22, there were none. So the humpback got down to a very, very low level in Irish waters. Now it's coming back. That is the great thing. It is now coming back. There was one in Liverpool a few years ago. Liverpool Bay caused a great deal of stir. Where I live on the Irish Sea, we're unlikely to see a humpback. There were sightings from time to time, but the poor old Irish Sea has a kind of an image problem, you know, cellar field and sewage dumping, and it's kind of enclosed and has an image of a polluted sea, and it hasn't got the mystique and armada wrecks and giant waves of the West Coast. But anyway, there are humpbacks in the Irish Sea, and I hope there will be more soon.
Tell us about WESPAS, Kieran.
Yeah, well, each year the Marine Institute carries out 3 large-scale fisheries acoustic surveys on board the Celtic Explorer. And some of these, particularly the Celtic Sea Herring Survey, extends back as far as the 1990s. So why are we out there? Well, the main purpose of the survey is to estimate the abundance and the distribution of some of our key pelagic fish species, including herring, sprat, blue-whiting, boarfish and a couple of others that you won't really see on your fishmonger's slab or in your restaurants. And this data feeds into the stock assessment process. So the WESPAS survey itself, we started the survey in early June in northern Biscay and worked northwards, finishing up in northern Hebrides about 42 days later. It's a huge survey. It covers sort of 60,000 square nautical miles. And how the survey operates, the ship steams along a predetermined cruise track, which is made up of equally spaced east-west parallel transects. And our echo sounders sample the water column directly below the ship up to 3 times a second, so we can quantify the fish that we see as we move along the track. When we see fish of interest, we use a pelagic trawl to take a sample, and this allows us to determine the species composition of the school or aggregation, and also the maturity and age profile of the individuals. And the survey covers the same geographical location each year and at the same time, allowing us to compare years and spot trends in the data. So gone are the days when we used to go out and just look at one single species in isolation, and now we look at the bigger picture from the micro scale sort of phytoplankton all the way up to the largest animals on the planet, such as humpbacks and fin whales.
Kieran, the image you conjure up is of a kind of Second World War submarine hunting with ASTIC and sonar and these strange sounds sent down into the deep listening back from the echoes. Now, this presumably is what you're at with fish. You're sending down a sound which bounces off the fish or something and comes back up. Now, what does the output look like? Do you have some kind of... In the war, you had this circular thing going around and the image would come up on a tower. But is it... And they would time the length of the echo sort of thing, how far away the thing, once the echo came at the same time as you were transmitting, you were right over the sub and you could fire the depth charges down. But in this case, what do you see if you're in the boat?
Yeah, really, really good question. You know, a lot of this technology, as you say, has come from, originally was developed for naval applications and has come into the sort of scientific realm now. So what we have are a number of different frequencies on board the ship. Certain species will resonate at different frequencies, and that allows us to identify the species based on their sort of acoustic characteristics, if you will. So we have a number of frequencies that look straight down onto to the seabed below the ship. We're in a really unique position with the Celtic Explorer in that she's regarded as an acoustically quiet ship, so we have diesel engines that drive electric motors which power the ship. So she's a very quiet ship in the water, the idea being that she won't scare away the fish that we're trying to measure and estimate. So what does it look like when we're cruising along our cruise track? What you'll see is you'll see the seabed, and then you will see, depending on the intensity of the echoes from the target species of the fish, you'll get a picture of the water column generated sort of up to 3 times a second, sort of very high resolution. And because we have a range of frequencies, it allows us to pick up everything from zooplankton all the way through to swim-bladdered fish such as herring. And pelagic fish work especially well for acoustic surveys due to the fact that they like to aggregate together into schools, which makes it a little bit easier for us to count them.
Now, you could take a few lessons from the bats, because they're at this for millions of years. They're into the acoustic business and transmitting at different frequencies and so on and so forth. Now, presumably, in our case, if we could hear bat sounds, we would be deafened because they are enormously intense, but they're outside our frequency range. In fact, it's been suggested that our acoustic abilities evolved to evade the huge power coming out of bats. Now, in your case, are you transmitting outside the acoustic spectrum of the fish? Can the fish hear this? Are you above the frequency or below the frequency or whatever?
Generally, we tend to be above the frequency at which the fish will detect them. The fish will likely respond to the pressure wave generated by the ship approaching, and rather than the signals that we emit. So we're kind of on the cusp, should we say, depending on the species of what's detectable and what's not.
Well, is it necessary to do so 3 times a second? It's not a vertical, it can't be a vertical pulse because sound diffuses out into a great circular wavefront. So the pulses 3 times a second seems enormously ambitious or enormously overkill, but that's just the impression of somebody who's outside it.
So, yeah, the reason we sample... The way we determine our sampling frequency, or our sampling rate, should I say, is based on the water depth. So it's the time taken for the pulse to reach the seabed and back again. And as you know, sound travels 3 times faster in water than it does in air. So what we do is we sample at the optimum rate to give us the resolution that we require. So obviously the faster we ping, the more data we acquire on each pass.
Well, now, has it changed your view of things? Prior to this technology, you had to use other methods of determining where fish were and in what quantity and so forth. Was that very primitive, and is it much better now? Do you know things now that you wouldn't have known then? Is your picture of the sea distribution in the Atlantic changed by this?
Well, we're in a really nice position that we're able to conduct the survey on the same ship at the same time, in the same area each year, and this really gives us a nice impression of trends that are occurring in and we see in the data from year to year. So stocks fluctuate naturally depending on lots of things. So that's why we take the broader approach when we look at not only the zooplankton and the physical, chemical and biological parameters of the water, characteristics of the water. And layer on layer, this helps us and gives us an idea of the larger picture, and it helps us describe the trends that we see in fish stock abundance.
So you're able to tell different species apart. Say you take the gadoids, the cods and pollocks and things of this kind. Can you tell those apart? They're all rather, they look rather alike, most of them, to us outsiders. Can you tell the difference between various species that well?
For some species, it's much easier than others. For gadoids in close proximity to the seabed, this becomes a bit more complicated. But for large schooling pelagic fish such as herring and sprat, blue whiting, for example, things become much easier. For example, one of the surveys that we do in the Rockall Trough in March and April, blue whiting, it's a species you won't come across very often. It's more of an industrial fishery, but the entire stock feeds in the Norwegian Sea in the summertime and then migrates down the west coast of Ireland to begin its spawning run. And we've encountered aggregations there, continuous schools that might be 60 nautical miles long and 200 metres deep. So incredible volumes of fish. So yeah, schools like that are much easier to count than one or two single cod close to the seabed.
But to get back to the humpback whales, why are they in Irish waters in ever-increasing numbers, do you think?
I think there's been, from the IWDG catalogue, the Irish Whale and Dolphin catalogue, there's been 119 individuals documented to date since 1999. Irish waters are on their part of their annual migration from the southern warmer waters off West Africa where they breed up to their northern feeding grounds. So Ireland is a sort of important feeding stopover for these animals. And they come here because the food's here. Just shows you the high productivity of Irish waters and, you know, the unique diversity of animals we have in this area. There's one particular individual who's been nicknamed by the guys at Irish Whale and Dolphin Group as Boomerang. And he's been returning to Irish waters for over 20 years. And we often see this animal in October when we carry out our Celtic Sea herring survey. The animal's a regular visitor to Irish waters.
It's great news, isn't it, Niall? You like to hear this too.
Oh, I do, absolutely. I love birds, of course, and I often think of whales in a similar way because, like birds, they sing. And I love the idea of whale song. I love the idea that they have this massive communication network deep under our oceans. And, of course, the humpbacked whale, it's one of the species that's most famous for its song. I remember a really interesting experience a few years ago. I went to visit a very good friend of mine, a guy called Matthew Medler, who works in the Macaulay Library of Natural Sounds in the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology in New York. And he called me into his sound recording studio and he said, listen to this is amazing. And he played me two sounds, and one was the sound of a humpback whale that had been sped up, so it was faster and higher pitched, and the other was the song of a wren that had been slowed down till the pitch was the same as that of a humpback whale. And it was very hard to tell them apart. I was really struck that the song of the wren and the song of the humpback whale, two species that you could never confuse with each other, that are completely different in terms of their size, their habitat and everything, have evolved very similar songs that no one would have expected. So that's something that I really do like about humpback whales. It's fascinating stuff.
We'll have to get Matthew on. Anyway, Kieran, thank you very much indeed for talking to us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And continued success with your work. That's pretty much all we have time for. My thanks to Aina Nilana, to Niall Hatch, to Richard Collins, Terry Flanagan, Jenny Brannigan and everybody else who took part in today's programme. Don't forget you can visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Until next time, goodbye.
That was Derek making those sounds, not me. Mooney Goes Wild was presented and produced by Derek, and he and the team will be back here next Monday night at the same time on RTÉ Radio 1 just after 10.